Hi, I'm Robert Osborne, and welcome to Turner Classic Movies' ongoing podcast series, Private Screenings Uncut, a chance for you to hear the complete, unedited audio from the interviews I've done with various people for TCM's Private Screening series. When I do one of these interviews for TCM, I usually sit with a person for a couple of hours, sometimes more, but only about an hour that ends up on the show. So Private Screenings Uncut is a chance for you to hear the complete conversation as it occurred. With this installment, we're going to bring you now the very first Private Screenings episode we recorded back in 1995. Actually, at the time, we called the show Real Memories, with real spelled R-E-E-L. We changed the series to Private Screenings a year later. And the guest who was gracious enough and willing enough to test the waters with us for this new show was Jane Powell, the star of such musicals as Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, 2 Weeks with Love, and Royal Wedding, and a dear friend to us at TCM since we launched. Jane Powell was born in Portland, Oregon in 1929, and she was an only child and was with many children of the Depression. Her parents encouraged her singing and dancing abilities. And as you'll hear, she talks about her early days in radio and theater, where she worked under her real name, Suzanne Burse. She also opens up about how at the age of 12, she was selected the Oregon Victory Girl. And during her reign, she had the chance to meet MGM star Lana Turner. Well, before long, MGM came calling for Suzanne Burse, signed her to a contract, and also changed her name to Jane Powell. As this interview strongly showcases, Jane Powell is incredibly modest as she talks about her successful career at MGM and what it was like growing up on a studio lot, going to school at the Little Red Schoolhouse with Elizabeth Taylor and Roddy McDowell, among others, even having Elizabeth as a bridesmaid at Jane's first wedding. Jane also talks about her personal life and husband Dick Moore, to whom she's been happily married since 1988. Jane is incredibly honest, and she even admits that if she had to do it all over again, she probably would not have chosen the path of an actress. But here she is, sharing her own memories during her great career at the height of MGM's musical days. Originally recorded in 1995, which we now bring you in its entirety, it's Private Screenings Uncut, Jane Powell.
Jane, I know you're not somebody who likes to look to the past too often, or you don't watch your old movies. You're certainly a very up-to-date person, and we really appreciate you being a good sport and being here and digging into the past with
us. Oh,
I
hope I can remember some of the past.
Now, at the age of 12, you were Susanna Burse, living in Portland, Oregon, and 2 years later, at the age of 14, you're Jane Powell, under contract to MGM, starring in a movie. How did that happen?
Well, I think I can remember that because it was kind of a traumatic thing. I had two radio shows in Portland, Oregon, and I was the Oregon Victory Girl. And of course, it was during the war, the Second World War, not the first. And I was going to California. My parents and I were going to California for a vacation, and the station of CBS said, well, since you're down there, why don't you get on this talent show? And it was called Stars Over Hollywood with Janet Gaynor. So I got on the show, and I won the contest. And the next day, I was called by Selznick and also by MGM to go for an audition and for an interview, and I was signed right there. And by, I think that this time it was about May or June. And it must have been June because I was out of school. And then in September, we moved down to California. And then there was an independent man, Charles Rogers, who was doing a movie. And he was one of the producers of Deanna Durbin movies. And of course, I was a classical singer, the lyric soprano. And they were looking for someone to play this part in Song of the Open Road with Charlie McCarthy, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields, and Sammy Kaye and his orchestra. And so they chose me, and that was my screen test. I had never been on screen. I had never read a line. I had never done anything. And I starred in my first movie. But I knew they were going to change my name because Suzanne Burse was too long for the marquee. And so I thought, oh, I wonder what they'll change my name to. And the name of the girl in the script was Jane Powell. Everybody's named Jane, and everybody, at least there were three Powells around. Anyway, they called me on the telephone one night, and I was ironing. I was in the kitchen, and I was ironing. And they said, hello. I said, hello, and they said, yes, hello. Is Jane Powell there? And I said, no, I'm sorry, you have the wrong number. And they said, no, we don't, honey, that's your new name. And that's how I got my name. I don't know why they couldn't type another name in, but that's how I got the name Jane Powell.
Did you take to the name right away? Did the name seem to fit you?
No, I didn't. I wanted my name to be Cheryl. I just thought Cheryl. Do you remember Cheryl Walker?
Sure.
She was at Warner Brothers, and for some reason, she was in a stage door canteen, and I just thought she was wonderful. Again, I kind of like character actors. Not that she was a character actress, but she was not really a star, but I love the name Cheryl. But that was not the name they chose for me, so my name ended up Jane Powell, and so they think that I'm related to Dick Powell or Eleanor Powell or William Powell, and I'm not related to any of them.
Now, life back in Portland, was that before you went to Hollywood? You said you were on the radio. How did all that happen, and was that a happy life for you back in Portland that you left to go to Hollywood?
I guess it was, Robert. You know, I've been dancing and singing since I was 2 years old. And people have said, well, how did you know you wanted to do that? Well, I didn't know I wanted to do it, but my parents thought that I did, because my mother said I used to tap dance on the fire, on the bricks on the fire, by the fireplace. And I don't know, I was on the radio and I sang and danced when I was 2 and 3 and 4. And you know, at that time you don't have much of a choice. The only thing that I missed was really being able to be with my peers and going to the parties that were done, because usually I was singing someplace for a Kiwanis club or a Lions club or some kind of a do like that. So I missed a lot of the school activities. And of course, children can be so mean, you know, they're always saying, oh, she's stuck up, or she always has to go here, and she has to do this, and she has to do that. And I tried so hard not to be stuck up that I really became a blithering idiot. I mean, I would just say yes to anything. I never wanted to say no to anything. And when I was offered these radio shows, and also to be the Oregon Victory Girl, it was just, I honestly didn't know how to say no. But I'm glad I did, because, you know, if I hadn't have done that, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today.
Well, we appreciate that. What's the Oregon Victory Girl? What was that?
Well, I would travel the state and sell war bonds.
So you're picked as a Victory Girl,
mm-hmm.
as it were?
Yeah, it was, I don't know, they just, another one of those names they picked out of the air. And I would travel the state and I would sing at the Army camps and the Navy camps. So basically, I sold war bonds. And so that was my war effort. And that time I was 12, 13, and then 14, I was in Hollywood.
Well, doing all these things, do you think it was because you were ambitious, or was your mother ambitious for you? Were you being pushed in this direction?
Yes, I was being, I wasn't ambitious at all. I don't know, people say, what would you have been if you weren't what you did?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I'd heard that garbage collectors made a lot of money, so I thought I'd be a garbage collector, or I'd be a secretary, because I've always tried to type, and I never could do it, and I'm still trying to learn how to type. I should really try to use out a computer right now, but I'm still trying to learn how to type. I have no idea what I would have done, but no, I was pushed by my parents. And I think that children of our era, because we were Depression children, we were the dream of our parents. And so we fulfilled their dreams in doing what they thought. And of course, Shirley Temple. I had my first permanent when I was 2 years old. And I had those bobbing curls, you know, that went up and down when you walk, like Shirley Temple's curls. And most parents wanted their, or a lot of parents wanted their children to be the next Shirley Temple, and mine were the same.
When did you find out you had a voice?
Well, I guess I've always sung, or I always sang, I should say. I don't sing anymore. As I say, at the age of 2, I mean, I was singing, and then I started taking singing lessons at the age of 10.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I was a singer instead of a dancer, but then it all kind of all goes together.
But I find it fascinating about getting this contract without a screen test or anything.
I know. And not only that, I had a wonderful contract from what I understand, because we didn't know, you know, how much money to ask or anything, but we had a wonderful contract, my parents and I. But I never had a screen test, and my screen test, as I say, was starring in my first movie, which was Song of the Open Road.
Now, working with W.C. Fields, what was that like? What was he like?
Well, I didn't realize he was the character that he was. And, of course, I hadn't seen too many of his movies. I'd seen a few of them with Mae West. But I didn't realize that he was kind of on his way out. It was kind of a funny thing, because he did imbibe quite a bit. in the grape or anything. It didn't make any difference what it was. And he kind of came out of the mothballs to do this movie. And all I can remember is that if we were going to go to lunch, they would have him, because it took place in an orange grove, and we were singing songs, you know, singing to the oranges and riding on our bicycles down avenues in the middle of the date fields and the orange fields and everything. And so they would get him on the truck, and they would call lunch, then they'd take the stairs away. Because if they didn't take the stairs away, he wouldn't be available after lunch, and so they would bring him his lunch. And he had a bar set up in the back of his station wagon that everyone's on the set seemed to love the back of his station wagon. And I had one scene with him, and he didn't cotton too much to children or animals, mm-hmm. and I don't think he cottoned much to me. Of course, he ad-libbed everything because he couldn't remember anything, and I had no idea what ad-lib meant, so I don't even remember the scene. I think it was like, hello, and he was like, where are you going, little girl? And he said something, and I think I left. I didn't see that much of him, and he wasn't in the movie that much, but he was there.
So you were a very natural actress then, because I've seen Song of the Open Road, and you're very good in it, and you had no acting lessons.
No.
And did they keep you away from acting lessons to keep this natural quality, do you think?
Yes, I think so, because I always played myself, whoever that was. I was the girl next door, and in all the movies, the parts were almost all the same. I had wonderful costumes by Helen Rose. The costumes changed, the songs changed, but the stories didn't change very much. And as a matter of fact, it's always been kind of difficult for me to learn lines the way they are written on a page, because they were my own words. I mean, they would have lines written, but then they didn't know how to write for a young child or mm-hmm. a young person. So a lot of the lines were the way that I would say them, and so it's. I guess that what you see there is what I was, except I didn't live that life. I lived a very simple life, much more simple than you ever saw on the screen.
I was going to ask about the life of this adjustment from Portland, Oregon. I mean, were you living in a big house, and did you have servants? And
oh, no.
Anything like that?
I've never had servants. No. We lived very simply. My mother handled the money, and I think she put it under the bed springs just in case the bank was going to collapse. We rented our first house. We lived in apartments for a long time, but we rented our first house from Donald Meek. Remember?
Oh, yes.
Donald Meek?
Absolutely.
The one, what
wonderful
was it?
Character actor.
Oh, wonderful. He was. And we rented.
You can't take it with
can't
you.
Can't take it with you.
State Fair.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he was just wonderful. Though I never met him, and he was an MGM. But we lived there for a while, and then we bought a house in the valley, but it was always very, very simple. And then when I got married, I left home and I left everything with my parents, and they had everything anyway.
Did your mother handle your finances in a way that was beneficial for you later
on?
Oh,
no. Oh, no, 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 no. No, everything went.
What about the Coogan Law? Supposedly the law, the Jackie Coogan Law, that so much had to be put aside in a bank, or I think, you know, the parents couldn't spend the money. But
well, the percentage that was put aside in the bank was so small. And not only that, you could go to the court and you say, well, we need to buy a house, so that could come out. There was hardly any money
really
put aside. And my mother didn't know anything about mm-hmm. investing and didn't trust anything. And my father kind of let my mother handle it. We came from, you know, very, very poor upbringing. We didn't have, and I'm an only child, we didn't have a car. We didn't have, not that we didn't have food on the table, we were fortunate to have enough to have that, but my mother came from a family of seven children, my father came from a family of three, and, you know, they were working people, and the idea of having a maid or having anyone do anything for you was, you know, that was for somebody else. We were very shy people, and didn't socialize very much because we honestly didn't know how. And I, in fact, I always felt like I was a fly on the wall when I was in Hollywood. I was up there looking down at myself and all of this happening, but I was never there. And Roddy McDowell, our dear friend, Roddy has such a wonderful memory of the past, and I really don't have too much because I never was there.
You never felt a part of the family of it then?
Never. And I never felt that anybody would ever know who I was. I remember one time I had done four movies, and as Dick, my husband, Dickie, who used to be Dickie Moore, was pointing out, he said, honey, he said, you never were in a movie that you didn't star in, which I had never realized that before. But I had starred in about four or five movies, and I was in the commissary one day, and I was having lunch with Marjorie Main, you know, mm-hmm. Marjorie, and she was such a character. She always ate with her gloves on, because she was so afraid of germs, and of course her gloves were not very clean, but she was a character. Anyway, we were having lunch together, and I felt someone come up behind my chair, and he said, hiya, Janie girl, and he winked. And I looked at him, it was Clark Gable, and I couldn't remember his name. Because I was amazed that he even knew my name, because I never thought that anybody knew who I was. I always stood in line and in the commissary along with everybody else. Not that I was trying to make points in any way, but I honestly didn't feel like I belonged.
But it was also that Portland syndrome of not wanting to be stuck up or spoiled,
I'm sure.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. And I would get letters from my friends in Portland. They would talk about, you know, the basketball games and going to the dances. And, oh, I was so lonely.
Really?
Because we were so, in our business, we were so isolated. If it hadn't been for Roddy's House on Sunday, I mean, we wouldn't have had any socializing.
What was Roddy's House on Sunday?
Well, Roddy always had a group of people, or his mother always had a group of people to the house on Sunday, and we'd swim and play badminton and you know, put the records on, and then she would have a big family dinner, and people of all ages, from anyone from our business, would be there. And it was a boon for me, because I went to school at MGM. I was the only one in my class. Elizabeth Taylor was in the room, and Margaret O'Brien was in the room, but they were all in different grades, and it was called the Little Red Schoolhouse, and that's how we had our tutelage, and it was 3 hours a day if we weren't doing a movie. And if we did a movie, then we took our schoolwork on the set.
So you'd actually go to a schoolhouse when mm-hmm. you weren't working, and you'd all be in the same room, but learning different classes, different lessons.
And we'd have maybe two or three teachers in the room that were teaching whoever was there, and every day it was different. Children from other studios would come over, and they would join the class, but they wouldn't be in your class, you'd just be in the same room. So that was there was so much. It was like a revolving door. You never really had any camaraderie. I mean, Elizabeth and I, as I say, we did movies together, but we're all working so hard, and we were so busy, and then not only learning our lines at night, we had to go home and do our homework if we were mm-hmm. on the set. So the only time we really had any socializing at all was at Roddy's house. And so there was a great deal of isolation, at least there was for me. And being an only child, I didn't have anyone to talk to. So when I would get these letters from my girlfriends, I really longed to go back to Portland. And I couldn't really tell them what I was doing, because I would sound stuck up. Mm. You know, if I said, oh, I met Clark Gable, or I saw so-and-so, and I would just say, oh, nothing really exciting is happening here, because I was almost embarrassed to say what was happening to me, because, first of all, I didn't think it was happening to me. I was a camera, and I was seeing it happening to somebody else.
It's interesting, because at that time, you were on the magazine covers of all the movie magazines and living mm-hmm. what probably was any teenage girl would think was the ideal life, but you weren't all that happy with it.
I wasn't there.
Did MGM at all make you feel a part of the family, or that you were a big star? Did they ever let you know what a big star you were?
Oh, no. No.
Did it surprise you when you would say go out on tour, say singing
if anybody showed up
in a theater? What did it surprise you that people were so excited to see you, and that there were fans at the stage door?
Yeah. But all I can say, Robert, is I honestly wasn't there. Only half of me was there. Because when I was on hiatus, I would work, I forget, was it 42 weeks? I forget how many weeks, I'm terrible with numbers also. I would work so long, and then we would have a vacation. We wouldn't get paid, so I usually would go and do the theaters. And I was doing vaudeville, and the movie would play, and then I would perform, and there would be other people on the bill. And, of course, that's where all the fans were. And we would do 8 shows a day, 7 days a week. And I couldn't even go out to lunch or dinner because the fans would be at the door. But it was still, it was not, it wasn't me.
It wasn't dawning on
no.
you. Now, those were MGM theaters you were playing, mm-hmm. doing your shows. Did you get extra money for doing that in addition to your contract fee?
Yes, but not MGM, I think the studio, because they would sell me. And so I'm sure I got maybe a fourth of what Metro was getting for me. Or whoever it
so
was.
So you were working all the time?
Yeah, I worked almost all the time.
Did you have a chance to have boyfriends?
No, I never had a chance to meet anybody. Because I tried everything, and I went to the ice skating. I met my first husband at an ice skating rink, Gary Steffen, and he was Sonia Hendy's ice skating partner. But I had maybe 2 boyfriends before that, and I think I was 19 or 20. But I was, chronologically, I was 19 or 20, but I was more like 9.
Did the studio try to keep you away from boys and everything, since they were selling you as the perennial teenage
Well, no,
girl?
I don't think anybody ever asked to see me.
I doubt that.
No, I don't think so. Well, I didn't go to nightclubs, and I didn't drink, and I didn't smoke. And, of course, we weren't even allowed to even have our picture taken by a television set at that time, because television was a no-no, and it didn't exist at all. But I was just kind of in between, mm-hmm. because being 18, I really wasn't 18 because I was very naive and very, very shy. And the studio, I don't think, tried to keep me young because they nobody asked me to do anything anyway. And I was never chased around a desk.
No, or the if producers they did, didn't chase you around?
Well, if they did, I didn't know what they were doing. But I don't think I was ever even chased.
One of the interesting aspects of the MGM world was the fact of publicity and the way they would set up publicity. And how much time did you spend like having photographs taken for magazine covers?
Oh God, I really, that all of us hated going into the still gallery. That was probably the bane of everyone's
That was
existence.
A separate area just for
yes.
photographs?
And they had a bungalow where they said, or else you go on location. And I can't say, it was too much, no matter what it was. Not only that, we would have the parties at the house where if there was a shower or somebody's birthday, then all the cameraman would come in and take pictures of everybody feeding each other and, you know, and making
So your
the
private
food.
Parties, they would send
private
publicity
yeah.
Photographers there to take pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have, I'd always heard that at studios like MGM, they would assign like one publicist just to handle you and another publicist maybe to handle Lana Turner or mm-hmm. vice person. Did you have one specific person that handled
yes,
you?
Well, I kind of about 3. They would kind of change off depending on, I guess, how busy they were. Ann Strauss was one that and Ann, who was a dear person, I think you knew mm-hmm. Ann Strauss. Ann was really just a lovely woman. We didn't like each other at all. We just couldn't stand each other until I grew up.
Oh, really?
And Ann was, I would have to do the fashion things, and he would always have me take off a ring or have me hold my pocketbook, because I'd be holding my pocketbook like this, and she says, no, you've got to hold it like this. And I was just so mad at her because she was always picking at me and telling me, and she was right.
Uh-huh.
She was right in everything that she said, but at that age, it was kind of hard to take that. But I never really got that close to people. And I don't know why. I guess I was just too shy. To this day, I have never had a dinner meeting at our house for business. Only friends come to our house. I always feel like someone's going to know what I'm doing, that I'm using them in some way. Mm-hmm. I've always been so afraid of using people that...
Or being interpreted.
Yes,
for using
and
people.
So I've really kind of shied away. I think I have more close friends now than I ever had before because I don't want anything from anyone and I can't give anything to anyone except friendship.
Except for Roddy McDowell, who I know is a close friend of yours now. Do you have any other people from that era that you grew up with that
No.
you would say is a close friend? Do you have any close girlfriends from that period?
No, I never had close girlfriends. I don't think really, I can only speak for myself, but just I assume that not many of us had close girlfriends, unless you went to high school before. Mm-hmm. And I never really got to high school because my high school days were spent at MGM. And I didn't have the chance to get that kind of camaraderie mm-hmm. of friends. I do find that most of the women that I know have a lot of their friends came from high school or mm-hmm. college, and I never went to college.
Now, Elizabeth Taylor was in your wedding party, and you were one of her bridesmaids, but was that studio control kind of thing?
No, I think it's because we didn't know anybody else.
I see.
And I have a saying, which is true, that I was bridesmaid at Elizabeth's first wedding, and she was bridesmaid at my first wedding. It's a good thing we stopped it, or it could have become a full-time career.
After you made your first two independent films, Song of the Open Road and Delightfully Dangerous, then you went to MGM and made your first big starring film there, Holiday in Mexico. You worked with people like Walter Pidgeon and Ilona Massey and Roddy McDowall and others. Were they all courteous to you? Because you were basically a newcomer and they were old pros, and yet it was your film. You were the star of the film.
Oh, they were wonderful to me, Robert. And these were all the people that I had seen on the screen in Portland, Oregon. And I was like a kid in the candy shop. I would never say hello to anybody unless they said hello to me first, because obviously, as I said before, I didn't think they knew who I was. But being with Walter Pidgeon, because I had been a great fan of his anyway. You know, he had a wonderful singing voice.
No,
he was
had
a singer.
No idea.
And just to watch him move, and the way he ate a grape. I mean, he was the most sophisticated man that I think I have ever met in my life. And Ilona hadn't done anything in a long time. Of course, there was Xavier Cugat was in that movie, mm-hmm. and it was like a movie within a movie, as far as I was concerned. Again, I was the fly on the ceiling, looking at this, watching how they make a movie.
But they were courteous to you and treated you like an equal.
Oh, they were wonderful to me. Oh, yes, they were wonderful to me.
Now, one of your next films was Three Daring Daughters with Jeanette MacDonald, who had
yes.
certainly been one of the great, great MGM stars of all time. And she was kind of on her way out a bit.
Yes.
And you were certainly the new diva, as it were, on your way in. How was she to you?
Well, Jeanette was Jeanette. The Iron Butterfly, they used to call her the Iron Butterfly, and I'd been a great fan of hers, and I thought she was one. She was playing my mother, and in fact, there were two other girls. Mary Eleanor Donahue was one of them, and Todd. Ann Todd was the other, and we were sisters. And Jose Iturbe, again, because Jose was again in Holiday in Mexico. I just remember one thing, and this is a little derogatory, but that's the only thing that I could think of that would be derogatory about Jeanette, because Jeanette had a fantastic sense of humor. She was a very funny lady, and of course, very beautiful. And I think she liked me, but I had a crying scene one time, and she was in bed, and Jeanette had a makeup box, and we always called it Pandora's box, because you never knew what was going to come out of it. And I had this crying scene, and I was behind the door, and I never had the drops, because it's easy for me to cry, but this
drops they used to put in the eyes
to make the tears. And so we had this scene, and every time I was ready to come in, she would say, Marie, my box. And so in would come Pandora's box, and she would, I had been all revved up to cry. And then we'd start again, and as soon as they said, roll it, and I think it's like, are you ready, Jane? And I say, yes. By this time, the tears were streaming down my face, and Jeanette would say, oh, Marie, my box. And off in would come the box again, and of course, the tears would all dry up again. And I think that she was trying to wear out my tears, but she never did.
You had an unlimited supply.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, that would be quite a thing for her to come back
yes.
and be playing the mother of not a grown daughter, but certainly a teenage daughter.
That's right.
So, but she was nice to you.
Oh, she was. She was wonderful. In fact, we went to South America together. There was a film festival where all of us went. Irene Dunne and Bob Cummings and Ann Miller, and of course Jeanette and Jean, and it was years ago. It must have been About 40 years ago, we went on this trip, and we all had a wonderful time. And I don't think there was ever any animosity, but there was just that little, that little quirk that goes along with being a star.
Now, a lot of your films at MGM were produced by Joe Pasternak, and we hear a lot about him today. What was he like as a man, or what are your memories of Joe Pasternak? He had his own musical unit at MGM, as I understand, like Arthur Freed had his unit and others. And this, how would the Pasternak unit work, or what was unique to it?
Well, I think the reason why I was with Pasternak is because he also produced Deanna Durbin. So he kind of understood this kind of light fantasy kind of movie, whereas the Freed unit had, you know, Fred Astaire and Judy Garland particularly, and it was had a little bit, a little more grown up and not quite as much fantasy and as light as Pasternak. Pasternak was I guess, wonderful, and he certainly made most of the movies that I was ever in. It was kind of a disappointment to me because I heard through the grapevine that he said things about me that I have no idea why he would say them, but he said things, personal things that were not, they were not nice at all. And from then on, I found it very difficult to be very close to
him. Was this while you were working with him, or after?
It was kind of after. And maybe he was disappointed in what had happened to his life, I don't know, but it was, what he said about me was not nice, and it wasn't right, and it was uncalled for. So, and I called, I did call him on it, and he said, of course, that he didn't say those things, but
it affected the relationship.
It did. Then. It did affect.
You mentioned Judy Garland. Did you get to know her well at MGM?
No, I would meet her at different affairs that we would have to go to, but I did her television show a couple of times, and that was fun. She was really a rare personality. She was a unique person.
In what way?
With all the trials and tribulations that she had, or that she gave to herself, or that the studio, she says, gave to her, she still kept climbing out of it. She just had that. She was like a mountain that just kept growing and growing and growing. And I don't think that she ever really felt sorry for herself. And even though she'd gone through so many things, that physically and mentally and financially, I don't think anything really touched her in that way. At least it never discouraged her in any way. I admire her so much for her courage and for her stamina that she had, because she was very ill and would go out and just perform like nobody else could perform.
You mentioned about Jeanette MacDonald having a great sense of humor. One hears that Judy Garland had this great sense of humor.
Unbelievable.
As well.
Just unbelievable. And I would just sit back and just listen to this, because you could not compete in any way with her as far as that was concerned.
Was there a lot of gossip at the studio that you were privy to or heard? I mean, when Judy Garland would get sick or when there would be problems, is that something that would buzz all over the studio and people would be talking, or that this star had been dropped or somebody was coming on the lot?
I never heard any of that, Robert. Mm. Maybe I was too short, it all went over my head. I don't know. But I really didn't. People would say, "Did you hear what's happened to so-and-so?" And I never heard anything about that. Not that I, because I like gossip like anybody, but I really didn't hear that much.
Did you ever get to know Lana Turner on the studio lot?
I've got to tell you about meeting Lana Turner. This is when I was the Oregon Victory Girl.
Back in Portland,
and I was either 12 or 13. Lana came to town, and I could still see her. She had on a polka dot hat, and she had on a polka dot, and she was very well endowed, and black and white polka dots. And I gave her the roses when she was on the stage, and oh, won't you kiss me on top of the head, you know, and all those things that you do to people that are children.
Flowers.
And your flowers. And I can remember going home and laying on the bed and thinking, I wonder what Lana Turner is doing right now. And I knew she was in a hotel room, and I just thought, oh, can you imagine? And, you know, it wasn't maybe 4 years later, I was on the lot with her. And so I told her that I had met her, and of course she didn't remember that. And every time I met her, I had to be introduced to her.
From then on?
From then on.
She never did remember you.
She never did remember me. Well, you see, I had a complex about that anyway, and she enforced it.
Wow. What about Spencer Tracy? Did you ever see Tracy or meet him?
Yes, I did meet him. I was privy to going on the set one time of, I think it was Pat and Mike. Pat and Mike, is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
And my singing teacher, because people weren't allowed to go on the set of Hepburn and Tracy. And I went on, and he was bigger than life, and she was just so frail and so wonderful. She was just the two of them together. To see the two of them together was like it was in the movies. Really.
When one was a star, as you were at MGM, could you go usually visit other sets, and did you do that a lot to watch other people work?
Well, I was really so busy all the time, Robert. I didn't have the chance to. I did a bit, but I was either going to school, or I was working, or I was taking singing lessons or dancing lessons, or going to the still gallery, which, as I say, we all hated.
So they kept you hopping.
Yeah, I really didn't have much time. And then after I finished school, then I kind of got married and had children. So when I'm basically a homebody anyway. So I didn't venture very far. And also I thought I was intruding.
Mm. Now Luxury Liner was one of your movies as a teenager that you made with George Brent.
Yes.
Tell us about George Brent.
Well.
And your life with George
Brent.
My
life with George Brent. Oh dear. Well, first of all, I loved that movie. And I think basically I loved it because of him. And from the time that we met, all I can ever picture us doing is laughing.
He played your father.
He played my father. And we never so much as had breakfast, lunch, or dinner together. But when we were on the stage, it was just we were just constantly laughing. And I was 17 at the time. And, of course, my mother was still on the set with me. And I was out of school, finally. And I just had always thought, oh, isn't he wonderful? I had a crush on him, really had a crush on him. Well, years later, how many years ago was it? I was doing South Pacific in San Diego with Howard Keel on stage. This must have been, maybe 15, 16 years ago. And I received a big box of red roses. And in it was this long letter, and the letter was from George. And he lived at this time in San Diego. And he told me how much he had always loved me. And I had never seen him since the movie. Never heard
him. So you're talking like
him.
40 years after now.
Oh, yes. I mean, we're talking about a long time. And this letter went on forever about how he said he would love to see me, but he's not well. And he had emphysema. He didn't say that, but he said he was not well and he would love to see me, but he proclaimed his love for me. And I thought, well, I've got to call George. So he was in the telephone book. So I thought, well, I'm going to try and see if he's in the book. And sure enough, he was. So I called him, and I said, George, this is Jane. And he went, oh! And he just kind of gasped a little bit. And I said, I want to thank you for the flowers. Now, why can't you come and see me? And he said, oh, well, no, it's been, I'm not well, and I can't come to see you and everything. I said, now, we're closing here this weekend, but I'm going to be at the Pantages Theater in Los Angeles. Could you come up? And he said, well, we'll see. I said, well, I'm going to call you again, see if you can come up. Well, sure enough, he came up. Now, he said, I do not want to come backstage, because he had always, in this letter, he said, your mother or somebody was always with you. And he said, that's why I never proceeded in inviting you out, or, of course, he was much older than I was. But still, he said, you were always so protected and so guarded. So he said, I will come to the theater. I will come to the matinee. But I will not see you afterwards. But he said, would you come and have supper with me afterwards at the hotel? And of course I said, oh yes, I would certainly be happy to. So we go to the theater and we're all peeking through the curtain backstage to see him. And he looked like Don Quixote. He had gray, beautiful gray hair and a gray goatee. And thin, he was, and I could never picture George as being thin, but he was very thin, he was still very handsome. So I went to dinner, I knocked on the door. He was staying at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, and he opened the door, and he went, shh. And he took me by the hand into the room, and on the couch was a robe, his robe, and he took off the robe, and here was a picture of the two of us that he had, and the frame was still intact, but the glass had even broken. And he said, I have carried this picture with me all over the world, and I just want you to know. And it was a picture that I had, the two of us still, and we were both laughing, and he had this picture. And so we had supper, and I was starting on the tour again, and so I would call him, and he would send me flowers, and he was very thin, and I would put him on a diet of gaining weight, and he gained 14 pounds, and we did this all long distance. And so I was gone for quite a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, but still we were in contact. And so he wanted me to come down to San Diego and see him. So I said, oh, yes, I will. I will come down. I want to meet your dog, Skipper, and meet his daughter. His daughter's name was Suzanne, which was obviously my name also originally. And I went to dinner with his daughter, very pretty lady. And then we saw each other a couple other times, and then he proposed to me. He wanted to marry me. And of course, I said, it's just, he said, you can live in Hollywood, and I'll live here. But he said, I really think that we should be married. And I was really taken back. I didn't know what to say to him. And I said, I don't think so, but let me think about it. And then I've kind of drawn a blank from then on, except then I remarried, and I called him, and he was very angry at me. And he was seeing a lady, I guess he liked long-distance romances, who lived in Hawaii, and he married her. I don't know if he ever moved to Hawaii or not. And then soon after that, he passed away.
Wow.
But it was a lovely.
So that when he proposed marriage was the first indication you really got that when he talked about loving you, he
yes,
was
that
talking
he really
about it in a
me.
Different way than you were thinking.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. It was an unusual situation.
One of your next films after that was A Date with Judy, where you worked with Elizabeth Taylor.
Uh-huh.
And Wallace Beery. The wonderful yeah. Wallace Beery.
Yes.
Curmudgeon-y Wallace Beery that we all love in the films. How did you find him as a...
He was a curmudgeon.
Was he?
And a few other things.
He played your father in that film.
Yes, he did. I had always loved him. In fact, the one movie that I loved, Tugboat Annie, which I just thought he was so wonderful in that, along with Marie Dressler. And I'd always been a great fan of his until I worked with him. And he really... I think he was a very unhappy man, and everyone I talked to has the same story about him. I thought he just didn't like me, but he never said hello to anybody. Did you know he was a kleptomaniac?
Well, I knew he stole things from the studio
a lot. Oh, yes, like canoes.
Mm-hmm.
And his props.
Furniture.
And then his clothes. He'd always take his clothes home with him, and he knew they were going to have retakes, and then he would rent them back to the studio. He was also very shrewd.
Good businessman.
Yes, he was a very good businessman. But he was not one of my favorites after I worked with him, unfortunately, but he still had a talent. Dick was telling me that the reason why they think that he was so mean is because he didn't know who he was, because he was always in the early movies, as you know, he would cross-dress, and he would mm-hmm. be dressed as a woman and as a man, and he didn't know who he was, so maybe that's why he was so mean, I don't know.
Carmen Miranda was in A Date with Judy and also Nancy Goes to Rio. Do you have memories of her?
She was probably one of the dearest people I've ever met. She was just, she wasn't at all flamboyant, not like her banana headdresses and her big, she was very little. Mm-hmm. She was shorter than I was. She was about 4'10", a little tiny lady. And so sweet and very shy. How she ever got to be this explosion. That she really was such an explosion is amazing, because that was not her personality at all. She was just a wonderful, wonderful lady. And she died so young. Mm-hmm. I believe it was a heart attack that she had.
Now, Elizabeth Taylor in this film, this was kind of one of her first films as a teenager. I mean, she'd been kind of a little girl in films until she did A Date with Judy. And she was younger than you. And yet, she kind of went right on and was put into adult roles.
Yes, she was.
Opposite Robert Taylor and wearing low-cut dresses and everything, and they kept you
and
in
she
long
filled them
curls.
Out very well. Yes.
Did you ever have any resentment about that, that they kept you as a teenager and let Elizabeth?
Yes. Yes, I really did. And even in A Date with Judy, she got to wear green eyeshadow, and I didn't get to wear any. Uh-huh. And I had no animosity toward her and no
right.
jealousy toward
no,
her at all.
Just the yes. aspect of it.
Yes. Well, Elizabeth was very well developed for her age, and I was, of course, a little jealous of that also. But I never felt that toward her, and never felt any jealousy toward her at all. But yes, I would like to have been the femme fatale. I never was a femme fatale, but I did get to kiss Bob Stack. He was my first screen kiss, but I think she got him in the end.
Scotty Beckett, that you worked with, had kind of a tragic ending.
Yes,
for as many young kid stars did, actors. Have you ever thought about what is the formula? Why did it work out for you as a survivor and everything? And there were so many like Scotty Beckett that it didn't work out that way, that they ended up in either drinking a lot or in bad straits. Is it something about the Hollywood syndrome when you're working as a kid that's very dangerous to be in, or is?
Robert, that is so difficult to answer because, at least it's hard for me to answer. Maybe my shyness and my not being there was a help. Since I say I was the fly on the ceiling and I was only half there, that none of that never penetrated. Maybe that has a lot to do mm-hmm. with it. I honestly can't say. I know there were a lot of disasters, but you know, there are a lot of disasters in other lives also mm-hmm. outside our business. But I just think that somebody up there was looking after me or over me or something, because I was only half there. And I never felt that I belonged.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's what saved me.
In 1951, you had one of your great years. June Allison, I believe, was first supposed to do Royal Wedding, and then
yes.
she got pregnant, and then Judy Garland was assigned the film, and she couldn't do it. And so all of a sudden, Jane Powell, basically a singer, but a major star at MGM, is doing a dancing role opposite the great dancer of them all, Fred Astaire.
Yes.
When did you first hear about that, and were you as shocked as Judy and June
they
must
called
have been?
Me on the telephone. I always got my offers over the telephone. I guess that's
the good
always,
news and the bad news,
right? And I'm always excited about who's on the other end of the telephone, because you never know who's going to be there. I still have that excitement
when a phone rings.
Uh-huh. I always have to answer it because first of all, of curiosity, but you just never know who's on the other end of the telephone. And with this, of course, again, this was the Freed unit. I was not going to be working for Pasternak. And I didn't know all of this had gone on, because I didn't know about June and about Judy. But I had never met Fred Astaire. And I'd been on the lot for a long, long time, because I think I was about 24, 25 years old when I did Royal Wedding. And everybody was in awe of him. No matter, you know, if you walk down the street, I know one time I was watching, it was Gower Champion and Bobby Van and Tommy Rahl, and Fred walked by these three dancers. And of course, you know, he has this wonderful lilt and flipping a cigarette, and they all tried to copy his walk, and none of them could. He just had, it was an inner something with him. So no matter where he was, everybody was in awe of him, and they all treated him very rarely called him Fred. But though I don't think that it was something that he wanted, it's just that people just felt that way when they were with him. So when I went to meet him, I didn't know what to say to him. But the movie, Royal Wedding, was about similar to the life of his life with his sister Adele, and they were dancers. And so I said, Mr. Astaire, when was the last time you and your sister stopped or danced together? And he thought for a minute. He said, well, Jane, I guess it was about, I guess we stopped dancing together about 1929. I said, oh, that's the year I was born. And so he said, oh, well, they keep getting younger every year. But all the dances had already been set when I got into the movie. So I learned all the dances within 3 weeks, which was, I guess, kind of unheard of and kind of a feat that they were very pleased about. And of course, I loved it because I had always danced, but not really danced. And of course, dancing with him. And I didn't dance. I didn't learn the routines with him. I learned them with an assistant. In fact, it was a girl even. It was a wonderful assistant, but we didn't, maybe we would rehearse for one day and then we would film it. So I didn't get to go through the creativity mm-hmm. with him, which I would love to have done. And they always call him such a perfectionist, and he was, but everybody at MGM, and I think everybody in our business is a perfectionist, or was a perfectionist. He wasn't any different, except he was unique.
Was he courteous to you?
Oh, yes, he was wonderful. But he's a very shy man. He was extremely shy. As a matter of fact, in the 70s, BBC came over to do an interview, a retrospect on him, and they wanted to interview me. And I said, well, I really don't think that I would be of any use to you because I don't know the man. And they said, well, we have interviewed everybody, and everybody says the same thing.
So no one got to know
him. Nobody got to know him. He was very private. We went to the same church, and sometimes I would see him there with his mother, and he would take his mother to church. And he was very close to his wife and to his family. And you see very few pictures of him socially. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't go to nightclubs. I don't even think he went to many premieres. He was a very quiet person.
Peter Lawford.
Yes.
Did you like Peter Lawford? I mean, he was your romantic interest in the movie, and you sing one of the all-time great songs, I think, Alan J. Lerner's song, Too Late Now, to
yes.
Peter Lawford in that movie.
Well, Peter, you know, he was, I certainly was not his style. Now, he could have been my style, but, you know, I was, even though I was in my 20s.
You liked the racier types?
Oh, yes, yeah, he liked the racier types.
Well, he was very social in the Hollywood
yes.
swim of things, exactly
yes,
what you weren't.
Was. Well, and he was, you know, a bachelor, and I was married, and but still, if I hadn't been married, he would have gone for someone else. That what you see on the screen is not what you saw afterwards. We never had any problems together at all. But I do remember one thing about Peter. We were doing a scene. They're in the carriage that. The Queen is in the carriage, and he's behind it, and he was in his bare feet because he was a surfer at that time. So he was, as soon as he finished work, he ran right to Malibu Beach, so he was, I think he had his trunks under his tuxedo at that time.
Not the most committed actor then.
No.
Ever.
No.
Jane, one of the wonderful movies in your catalog is 2 Weeks with Love, which you made with Anne Harding and Louis Calhern, among others, also, of course, Ricardo Montalban. But you have always said that you like the character actors you worked with most of all of any of the people you worked with in Hollywood. What was Louis Calhern like? You did several films with him.
Yes, Louis played my father in a couple films, and I always loved Louis. He had so many wonderful stories, and being a New York actor as he was. And at one time, I guess he had a drinking problem, and he figured out his wardrobe. He only wore black and white. Because he could never get any of the colors together. He'd wake up in the morning. So he knew that he would have a white shirt, black tie, black jacket, black socks, and black shoes.
Good formula.
He wouldn't have any problem at all. He was just a wonderful man. He had a nickname for everybody. I was Beanie. His wife was Slats. And I don't know all the other names that he had, but one day he was reminiscing about different things, and I said, oh, Louis, you just have such wonderful stories. He says, Janie, you wait. You will, too.
Oh, interesting.
I don't think mine will ever come up to his because I didn't have as flamboyant a life as he had. But it's true. The older you get, you always have stories to tell and memories, if you can remember them.
Now, Debbie Reynolds also, I don't think she made her movie debut in that, but it was her first big kind of push toward mm-hmm. success when she did 2 Weeks with Love. What was she like as a kid?
Well, Debbie was the same then as she is now. She's just all over the place.
Right.
Our birthday happens to be on the same day. I always say that she was my prematurely born sister. We're a few years apart, but our birthday is April 1st, and so we have celebrated a couple times together. And Debbie is a highly talented lady, and she was a highly talented child also. But I don't know how old she, well, yes, I do. She was, I guess she was about 17 or 18 when she did that movie, because I was 20. I was 21. We had our birthdays at the same time at that time. But I love that movie because it was the first period picture I ever did. Mm-hmm. And also I had a dream sequence where I had a pink corset and an umbrella and danced with Ricardo. We did tangos and, oh, it was a wonderful movie. In fact, I really think it's my favorite movie of all the ones that I've done.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Now, clothes. You've always liked clothes.
Yes.
Even as a kid, you liked clothes. And you make most of your clothes today, is that true? Or design them?
I design them. I don't make them. But yes, I always did paper dolls and would color them and then put them on the paper dolls. And, where was I not too long ago? I think it was in South Bend, Indiana, and this lady brought me a scrapbook. The scrapbook is this thick. And the terrible, terrible thing is I never got the lady's name. I did have her come backstage, and I talked to her, and she wanted me to have this wonderful book. But she said she also had paper doll cutouts. And a lot of these things, I didn't know that I had paper doll cutouts.
You mean Jane Powell paper dolls?
And I didn't know there was a coloring book. All these things, that just kind of came.
So that was MGM merchandising that
was
you weren't aware of.
That was part of your contract that you did, that you had those things. But no, I've always loved clothes, and I used to wander around the wardrobe department, and also the seamstresses they always had the black velvet pincushion on their wrists, and the things they could do, and you know, even our petticoats, all those. The underpinnings were as beautiful as the overdress. The petticoats, if I wore, it was a time of petticoats, and it were three or four petticoats, they would all be different, and they would all be different kinds of lace, different kind of ruching, different kind of ribbons, different colors. Some of them were crystal pleated. I'm sure you know what crystal pleating is,
no, but,
my dear.
But these were things that weren't even seen
weren't
by
even
the audience.
Seen.
Wow.
They were just made so beautifully, and of course Helen Rose did most of my things, and for me, she was just ideal. She did my wedding dress, did Elizabeth's wedding dress, Grace Kelly's wedding dress. But she did many other things other than wedding clothes. But
so at a studio, did they usually have one designer for a star? I mean, a certain...
Usually...
So they would know your body better than
somebody
else?
Well, and also your style.
Your style.
I think it kind of went... And they would go over and they would do other things too. But basically, I know that when I did Royal Wedding, Irene? I think it was Irene. But they had bought a lot of the clothes for Judy, and then she did a few things. But Helen was, she was really just did wonderful, wonderful things. I loved her clothes. But that's one, unfortunately today, I think that the clothes, everything looks very much the same, and nothing is form-fitted and very loose, and it's very difficult to find things, particularly for a small person. My size is kind of hard to do, so I have a dressmaker and I still design and I copy a lot of the things that I've had before in different fabrics, but I don't dress up as much as I used to, because living in the country, living in Connecticut, I guess spend a lot of times in sweat clothes and
so you live in New York City and Connecticut.
And in Connecticut, yes.
And I know you like to cook.
Yes.
You're a wonderful cook. Have you always cooked?
Yes, I have. I've cooked since I was about 5 years old. My mother didn't like to cook, and she didn't bake at all, and I was a chocoholic. I've never had a glass of milk without some chocolate or something in it, because I just love, I used to put chocolate syrup on my cornflakes. Everything, I had chocolate syrup
you
on everything.
You are a chocoholic,
yeah.
Then, yes.
And so Mama never made anything, so I started baking brownies when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And she didn't like to cook, and so my dad did for some reason, and so he and I would kind of cook, and I've been doing it ever since. And I've never had a cook; I've just always done it. In fact, when I was on the road, I used to order my groceries long distance for the children. And I remember one time, I was on location; I had all the children. We were in Mexico, and we were coming back on the 23rd of December. I ordered all of my groceries by telephone. Had them all in the house, and I did Christmas Eve dinner for 30 people the
wow.
next night. But I love it. I love to cook, and I'm always looking for new recipes and trying new things. And of course, with our garden that Dick keeps in Connecticut, he grows the chili peppers, and I make the chili pepper jelly, and I make a few other things like that.
And you're happy doing that?
Oh, I love it. Yes, that's my therapy. The kitchen is my haven. In fact, we added on the kitchen to our house, and it's an ideal kitchen for me. And I should have made the counters a little 2 inches lower because of my height, but can't do that.
How tall are you exactly?
Well, I used to be 5'1½", but getting older, I get shorter. Pretty soon, you won't see me at all.
I'm so glad you're here before you disappear.
Yes.
1954, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, one of the great films in your catalog. Is that a happy memory for you?
Oh, yes. It was a wonderful, again, it was another period piece. And that was with Jack Cummings. He was the producer of that. And it was not supposed to be a success. As a matter of fact, half of the budget was taken away from Jack Cummings. And he persuaded the studio, because they didn't want to make the movie. And he persuaded the studio that he wanted to do it. And so they cut the budget because they took the money and they gave it to Brigadoon, another movie that they were making that they thought was going to be the big seller.
So they thought, when you say it wasn't supposed to be a success, they thought it wasn't going to do well?
Mm-hmm.
It had
no potential at all.
Hmm.
And it was they called it a sleeper. And after it was made, it was called a sleeper because it ended up at Radio City Music Hall. And they thought that that Brigadoon was going to go to Radio City Music Hall, which it didn't. And of course, now it has become a classic. And it was wonderful. The dances really are what made the movie. And Michael Kidd was a choreographer, and he created such a feel for that picture. Really very, very different, and nothing has ever been done since then.
Did you have a feeling when you were making it, you personally, though, that it was a good film? Or did you go along with the studio thinking that it was maybe not going to be
well,
a success?
Well, I didn't know that they didn't want to make the film.
Mm.
I was never really privy to any of that anyway, as to whether it was going to be good or what the budget was or anything like that. I learned this afterwards. But it was different. But again, being different, it could have been a bomb too.
Now you made two films directed by Stanley Donen. Was he a good director for you? Did you feel he brought the best out in you? Royal Wedding and Seven Brides, certainly two of your best films.
That's a hard question to answer, because I had also worked with Stanley on Holiday in Mexico. He was the choreographer of that. Because basically he was brought out to MGM by Gene Kelly,
mm-hmm.
and he was a dancer, and then he became a choreographer. Well, first of all, when I did Royal Wedding, being the third person, I don't know what Stanley gave me. Maybe he gave a lot to the movie. I really can't tell. It's very difficult to see what a director really does for a film, unless they edit it themselves. And maybe he did edit it himself. I don't know what Stanley did. I do feel like the star of the show was Michael Kidd in Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
The choreographer.
Mm-hmm.
That he's the one that brought the big vision and the image to
the movie?
I
believe he was, and also Jack Cummings. I don't mean to take anything away from Stanley because I don't know how much input he had into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who it was that chose Michael Kidd, but whoever chose Michael Kidd is the one that is the genius, because that was really the paramount interest of the whole
mm-hmm.
of the whole movie.
Now, in the meantime, between 2 Weeks with Love and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, Louis B. Mayer had been kind of booted out of MGM,
mm-hmm.
and he's a man you liked, and the studio was then taken over by Dori Sherry.
Yes.
Was it a vast change from your standpoint in MGM when the two heads of the studio changed like that?
Oh, yes. First of all, Mr. Mayer and I were very close. I think it was a father-daughter relationship, because I never saw the things that I hear about. In fact, I didn't know he was supposed to be an ogre, because he had never, again, not being in on the gossip, I had never experienced that at all. He had been such a wonderful, wonderful man to me. And I went to see him one of the last days that he was there. And I know the first time I walked into his office when I was 14 and I went for the audition, I thought that I was walking through a hall of horrors, because I thought that his desk must have been 2 miles away from the door. And every time I walked into the room, the desk got closer to the door. The room got smaller. And Mr. Mayer was always in shirt and tie and jacket. I never saw him any other way. And his glasses and his gray hair. And he was always, as I say, very sweet to me. And this day, I went to see him to say goodbye to him. And he was in shirt sleeves and suspenders, no jacket. And he was just sitting at his desk just like this. And I told him how sorry I was. It gives me a lump in my throat still to think about it. I said, I'm just so sorry about what has happened. And he said, Jane, he said, where did I go wrong? And I couldn't answer. Then he walked over to them. He had a little anteroom, and he walked over to the anteroom, and he looked through the Venetian blinds, and he looked out at the parking lot. He said, where did I go wrong? What have I done? And it was the first time I realized that we're all the same. We all are unwanted at one time. We are all lonely. We are all lost. And he was lost.
And vulnerable. Well, it certainly changed the face of MGM and the films that were done there. Did you like Dory Sherry?
I liked Dory Sherry.
Did you have much interaction
with him? No, I didn't, because I left the studio not knowing they were going to fire me anyway, because I wanted to grow up. And at this time, I guess I was about 25 or 26 years old. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just go someplace else, and, you know, and I will be a femme fatale, and I'll just keep doing the same things. But I didn't realize that other studios weren't making musicals either, and nobody else wanted me. And so MGM didn't either. They were going to let me go, which...
Now, how did you hear this, or...?
I heard it after I said I wanted to leave, and they weren't going to make musicals anymore, because Dory Sherry came in. He was basically a writer.
Right.
And so he did the war pictures, and everything got much heavier, and they got away from musicals. And so I would not have... lasted if I hadn't decided to leave anyway. The studio did change, and then, of course, and I did like Dory Sherry. I liked him personally very much, but I never worked for him or worked with him, and he wasn't at the studio too long. Since then, you know, the turnover, of course, there is no studio anymore, really, but no, there was great change when he came in. Well, maybe that was the change of everything, because television really was coming in and getting such a foothold. And the studios did not want to admit that television ever existed, let alone that it was going to stay. As I mentioned in the first of our talk, that we weren't even allowed to have a picture taken by a television set.
Amazing. Now, there was talk at one time of you doing Love Me or Leave Me.
Yes.
That would have been an interesting choice for you to do that. And did you ever find out why you didn't?
Well, I found out. Yes, I did find out why I didn't do it. Doris Day did the movie. And it was the Ruth Etting story. And I didn't know who Ruth Etting was. I had heard a few of her records. But I guess that the studio at that time thought that I was too immature. But again, was it Marty Melcher? Is that who Doris Day was married to? I guess Warner Brothers was going to let Doris Day go. And MGM didn't know that, so he convinced, now this is a story I heard, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I think there could be some truth to it. He convinced MGM to let Doris Day do Love Me or Leave Me, and so I didn't get to do it. But a couple years ago, I read an interview that Ruth Etting had given, and she said she had always wanted me to play the part because we were more alike than Doris Day or anybody else. And so that made me feel wonderful. But I would love to have done it because it was a more grown-up part. And she had a very difficult life, and it would have been a nice acting part, too. Mm-hmm. And Doris was wonderful in it, but that's one that I wish I could have done.
Any others that come to mind?
No. I did test at Warner's for... It was either Carousel or Oklahoma. It was the one that, Shirley Jones did. The one that Shirley Jones did. And I tested for that, and I didn't get it. But she had just won the Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but she...
Could it have been Music Man?
Maybe it was Music Man. It could have been. One of those I didn't get.
Was it traumatic for you leaving MGM? I mean, you'd grown up there, you'd spent so much of your life there, and were actually protected there and, you know, taken care of by the studio, kept busy by it, and all of a sudden you're at leisure. Is that was that a traumatic thing for you? Or by this time you were married, of course, and having kids.
I didn't think it was going to be, but it was, because nobody wanted me, because I was the girl singer. And there weren't any, nobody wanted girl singers. And I just thought, oh, well, I'll leave here, and, you know, I'll, because I just thought, basically, I thought that's the way life worked, because I had been at MGM since I was 14, and now I was 25 or 26 years old. And I didn't know that there was a big world out there. Now, I had done some theater, because on hiatus, I would, as I said, go and do vaudeville, and I did a couple of summer stock shows, but not too many, just a little bit. Well, I ended up doing nightclubs and television, and then doing the summer stock. But I find that's one time I realized there's really maybe nothing worse in the world than not being wanted, and I really wasn't wanted. My timing had passed. And I think that's one reason, Robert, why now it just amazes me that I'm still around. And thank heaven for MGM, or I wouldn't be.
Well, you've been very busy. Certainly, you did a lot of national companies, road tours. You had a big success on Broadway and Irene and all of that. But the thing that I find is so interesting is the fact that you seem to have such a great take on all of that and your place in all of that. Do you find that there are an awful lot of people that that still revere those times that you run into, that love the old films?
Oh, yes.
And love your position in those films?
Well, that they still remember me is just so wonderful, because I think I never knew my potential at that time, as we have talked about before, and my popularity. I never realized that people really knew that I existed, and I don't know, it's just kind of like a new wave, and moving to New York was really such an eye opener to me, because I would walk down the street and people would say hi, Janie, and taxi drivers or even today people stop me all the time and say, oh, I've loved your movies, and oh, you're the first movie I ever saw. Oh, last year I was walking down 66th Street, and a lady got out of her car, and she followed me, and she stopped me. She said, "Miss Powell," and she had a foreign accent, and she said, "You are Miss Powell, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes," and she said, "Oh," she said, I forget what country she was from, but she said, "I was not allowed to see movies, and I was." She was secluded someplace, and she said, "I had a picture on my wall of you," and she said, "Every day I'd wake up and see your face, and I knew it was going to be a happy day." And she said, "I just wanted to say hello," and off she went. And this happens all the time. I mean, what better gift could you have than that?
In 1986, there on the Academy Awards show, you had a big get-together with all sorts of MGM ladies together in one number.
Was that the year it was?
Yes, Esther Williams and Leslie Caron and Catherine Grayson and Debbie Reynolds. And you, was that a fun get-together, a fun reunion, or did you feel isolated at that time still? Have you ever felt more a part of that family now from a perspective?
Yes, the older I've gotten, the more I feel like we have more camaraderie. And I don't know whether it's my doing. I think that I finally feel grown up. And I was, because at MGM, I was always treated, they say, never change, stay as sweet as you are, and they'd pat me on top of the head. I never made any decisions. The only decisions I ever made was to get married and to leave the studio. That's all, to get married, to get divorced and leave the studio. Those are the only decisions I really ever made. And so I never really felt that I could even have a conversation with these ladies, because they knew how to say no. And they knew they could make decisions for themselves. So now I feel like I'm grown up, and it was fun. And we have since then seen each other at different affairs, and I find out that they are not just stars, and that they are people like I am. because I was really in awe of them. I've mm-hmm. always been a big movie fan. And I guess I just never got Portland out of my veins. And so when I see movie stars or a theater, particularly movie stars, I guess, because that was my era, I'm still kind of a little nonplussed, and I don't really want to say hello to them before they say hello to me, because I don't want to intrude in their life. But I'm feeling more grown up these days, and it's about time.
If there's anything you could change, what would you change about those years or about your life? Seeing the hindsight that you have now on some of those things, would you have said no more often, or would
yes.
you have?
Yes, I wish that I had, and I wish that I could remember being there. I really wish I had have been there. If I could, I wouldn't want to change any way that I feel today, or my life in any way today, because I feel like I'm more successful today than I've ever been, personally. And otherwise, I feel more successful. I just wish that I had been more aware and been able to say no.
Now, about life today, you have a wonderful husband, Dick
yes.
Moore. And you have how many children?
I have 3 children, and I'm a grandmother.
You're a grandmother.
Finally, yes. I have a son, Geary, who is 44, and a daughter, well, we call her name is Suzanne, but we call her Sissy, and she's 43. And then my baby, who is 39, and she's the one that has the little grandchild.
And do you get to spend a lot of time with your kids, or do you see them often?
Not as often as I would like to. I live in Connecticut and New York, and they live in California and in Colorado. But we talk a lot, and in going to California, because I sometimes have work out there, I get to see Lindsay a little bit more. But she's moving to Colorado now, so I probably won't be able to see as much of her and the baby and her husband, Richard. But in this scrapbook that this lady gave me from South Bend, all the pictures of some of them that I didn't even have that this lady has cut out of movie magazines, and when I see the children, it's just it brings back such wonderful memories to me. Of course, now it's very strange. I know I have heard young people say that when they see their parents growing older, it's very sad. Well, I hadn't seen my middle daughter, Sissy, for a while, and I had seen that, not that she was old, I don't mean that, but she was older. And it was the strangest sensation when you haven't seen your children, because you always think of them as still being babies, and when you see this child, now a mature 40-some-year-old woman, it really took me back a little bit, and I said, boy, it happens to everybody. She looks wonderful, and it was obviously there's nothing wrong with her, but it was just kind of a shock to think that your children grow up also.
If Susanna Burse was starting out today, do you think she'd want to be in films, or do you think there would be a place for her in films?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
And doing what I did?
What would you do today if you were starting out today, do you think?
I'd probably be a cook. I would probably go to cooking school, if that was what I were going to do. And as far as the business is concerned, I don't think I'd do it. It's much more difficult today, I think, because there is no tutelage, there is no Hollywood, there is no studio, there is no one to guide you. There's no one to guide the producers, the directors, the writers, or anyone else, because everybody now is independent. Which is the way everybody wanted to be. But it's really scary out there. And not only that, Robert, you know, there are no B pictures anymore. There are no C pictures anymore. Everything has to be an A picture.
And a blockbuster.
And a blockbuster. Mm. And that's impossible. Everything cannot be a blockbuster. People have said to me, do you think movies are as good as they used to be? And I said, well, you know, we had bad ones also. I mean, we had the A, B, C, and sometimes mm-hmm. the D movies, but we don't have those anymore. Everything has to be an A movie, and that is very difficult. The competition is so great today, and you have no protection, and everything is so expensive, and you are independent, but really you're very dependent on the banks and a lot of things. So being a producer today, I would think, would be very difficult also. It's a hard time. It's a very hard time because there's no center.
Jane, at one point in your life, you were social in Los Angeles and in that Hollywood community with the Reagans, I understand.
Yes, that was before Ronnie had run for governor.
Uh-huh.
Or he was very always been very politically minded. And of course, I knew Nancy at MGM,
right?
And she was a very good friend of Ann Strauss, the publicist that was at Metro, and we lived kind of close to each other. And as a matter of fact, Patty, their daughter, is the same age as Lindsay, my youngest uh-huh. daughter, and so we saw each other quite a bit of each other. And we always used to say about Ronnie, because Ronnie does like to talk, he not only likes to talk, but even has something to say. But the adage is that, the old adage is say, well, ask Roddy the time and he'll tell you how to make a clock.
Uh-huh.
And so we always say, well, let's just stay off anything that could get too deep, because uh-huh. Ronnie just likes to kind of go on and on. And Patty had always had a mind of her own. I know one time she came to a Halloween party that I gave for Lindsay, and she didn't want a bob for apples. So I said, well, why don't you go home? And she said, I think I will. So we called her mother and off she went. No, I did see quite a bit of them. They're very sweet people, and I'll tell you, I've never known the pictures you see of them holding hands. That is a picture I will always see of them in my mind's eye, because that is the way it has always been. As from the very first time that they met each other, they're two people, but they really are one. They're really quite an unusual couple.
You have quite happy memories of most of the people you've worked with, positive memories, mm-hmm. as we talk about. Was there anybody that you really, well, we know Wallace Beery wasn't one of your favorites, but any others that popped to mind that you really didn't like? Anyone you didn't really like working with?
Well, there was only one person that I didn't seem to get along with, and I think it was because she was playing my mother, and she'd never played mother parts before. And that was Hedy Lamarr. And for some reason, she really did take a dislike to me. At least I think she did. I know one time we were doing close-ups, and it was her close-up. And usually when you were doing close-ups, you were at one side of the camera and they're speaking to you, and they were doing the close-up on her, and I was on the side of the camera. So I asked the cameraman, do you want me to dress to the left side or the right side of the camera? And then everybody started to laugh. And for some reason, and they thought that I had something and they were making fun of her, and she left the set and she didn't come back for 2 days. And I had never seen anyone perform like that before, mm. because I had always been blessed by being with people that loved what they were doing, and they were professional and they did what they did. But she was, I don't know, she just probably was not happy at that time of her life, and she was very, I think what was a big drawback with Hedy is that I don't feel like she felt she had anything else but her beauty, and her beauty was starting to fade, and I think along with that her heart went with her, and she was not a happy lady. But I would say that's the only person I ever worked with I didn't get along with,
mm-hmm.
and I just found it kind of strange, but you know, you can't please everybody.
You were so much a product of the studio system. I mean, working within the studio system, which doesn't exist today. If you were starting out today, do you think that you would want to be in an actress or in pictures, follow that kind of course, that line of your career?
If it were the way it is today?
Yes.
No, I think it'd be much, much too difficult today. Because, you know, they always ridiculed the studio system, because you didn't have your independence, and you couldn't do this, and you couldn't do that. Well, now that everybody has it, they don't know what to do with it, because everybody is independent. You're independent, but still you're dependent on money.
Mm-hmm.
And at least when you had the studio, you had a guidance. There was a structure.
Mm-hmm.
There is no structure today. And there is really no real Hollywood, per se, because you can go all over the world, and people, unfortunately, have to go all over the world now because of the financing and of being able to work in different states that you can get a better buy as far as having a crew or whatever it may be. And the union problems are not as strict in some states as they are in California and in different places. But I think it's very difficult today not having a guidance. So the studio system really was the way to go.
So even though the work that you had to do in the 24 hours a day work and in the place where you were having your photograph taken for magazine covers and all of that
Thank
the time.
Thank God I did.
Yeah. So yes. So those kids today don't have the advantage of
no,
all of that.
No, they don't. You know, they do a picture and they become a big star in one picture. And then unless they make the right choices or they get a chance to be with a great producer and a great director, you may never hear from them again. Mm-hmm. Whereas a studio, they gave you all of this tutelage and this growth because you were an investment to them. But nobody's investing in the young people today. You're investing in yourself. Mm-hmm. And then you just hope that you get picked by these other people that are doing things. But I think the producers today have almost as much trouble as the performers because they've got to get the money. Mm-hmm. And they have to have the stars to get them the money. But basically, everybody's still working for somebody else. You mm-hmm. never really are that independent. Mm-hmm. And then you have your distribution problems, and you have your international problems, and it's there's no one taking care of that. You really have to kind of take care of all of that yourself. And the young people today have to find a publicist, have to find someone to take the still pictures, have to get the dancing lessons, have to get the singing lessons, have to do all of this on their own. Whereas at studios, when the time was, we had the studio system, all of that was, and the best mm-hmm. was at your fingertips.
And that's a key word, the best. You had the best people there
we
to teach you.
We had the best of everything, really. And if you really didn't particularly like it, they would send you to someplace else, another teacher, or maybe try you on someone else. But still, they were your parent, mm-hmm. and it was wonderful.
Now, singing lessons at the studio you had, mm-hmm. and did you have actually, now you never had acting lessons before you started in your first film, did you have acting lessons later on? Did they coach you at all, or?
Not that much, Robert. Lillian Burns, of course, was it, and she was the acting coach or teacher. And I went a bit, but I didn't go that much, because basically, as we talked about before, I kind of played myself. And I had a few lessons with her, and the one thing she did teach me is don't wrinkle your forehead, Jane, because I used to talk with my eyebrows. And that was a wonderful lesson, because I don't have that many lines in my forehead, and I should if I really talked with my eyebrows the way that I did. So that's kind of about all I had, but I did, not that she didn't try, but I just didn't really have that much time to get my dramatic lessons in.
Do you think that if Louis B. Mayer had stayed at MGM, there may have been a structure for you to progress beyond the singing musicals that you did? Was there that kind of a plan, do you think, for you?
I haven't any idea. Usually everybody is put in a box. Mm-hmm. I mean, little Johnny Jones is always, even if he works for his father, he's still, it's little Johnny Jones. It's not big Johnny. And people get boxelated.
Right.
And whether I could have gotten out of that, I think today there is more chance of getting out of your particular niche that you're put in than it was at that time.
Especially when you've done so well for them
with
that niche.
It's safe.
Why take you out?
That's
it's
right.
Not
and
broke,
it's
don't
safe.
Fix it.
Mm-hmm. And today, people don't, if they play it too safe, it's dangerous. And if they don't play it safe, it's dangerous. And then they have nothing to fall back on. Whereas if a studio would take you out of that niche and it didn't work, they could throw you back in the other box. Mm-hmm. But today, you just really have to chance it.
Now, you made a conscious decision not too long ago to never sing again. And
yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, the time had come, Robert. First of all, being a singer or being a dancer is like being an athlete. And the muscles have to be exercised all the time and exercised in a certain way. I didn't have the best coaching and the best singing teachers. I don't know why, and I tried a lot of them, and I was very consistent in going to my lessons. And I would stay with the teacher for a long time. And I had a natural voice. But then when you start, the natural voice can only last for so long, and then you need great teaching to preserve that. And I don't think that I had that. Again, I'm now 66 years old, and it's, you know, things start flapping around, you know, things start falling. I always say, you know, if you don't exercise, it all falls down or it all falls out. The same like brushing your teeth, if you don't, they all fall out. So, it's something that you have to keep, and the flexibility that you used to have. Most singers, most dancers, they stop at this at a later age because the muscles don't respond. And I found myself being disappointed in what I was doing. I wasn't doing it as well as I used to. I thought I was disappointing people in not singing the way I used to. And it was, not only that, there aren't as many places to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. There aren't that many nightclubs, which I don't really want to do anymore. I don't want to travel because my life is so happy, and this is the life I wanted all my life, and I finally have it, so why change that? So giving up singing, people say, oh, don't you miss it? I don't miss it at all. I thought, you know, I've had it all my life, and I've been doing it since I was 2. And I think that, you know, 64 years is long enough to start doing something like that. And I don't miss it, and I know what it's a little bit even more than that. I envy people that chose what they wanted to do. And my life was chosen for me. Hmm. And I think that, and I've been very much aware of that since I moved to New York. When I see these wonderful young people that are working as waitresses and waiters and whatever they can do, just so they can take their singing lessons. And all of that was given to me. And it wasn't really my choice. I'm not sure I would have chosen my life. I'm glad I had this life, and I wouldn't change that. But I think to be able to choose your life is such an advantage. So now I can choose my life, and I choose not to sing. And I think that's probably why I don't miss it. And I don't envy anybody that does it. I admire people that do that and continue to do that. But the time does come when you really can't embarrass yourself anymore.
If we're sitting on this couch 10 years from now talking, what would you like to have had happen in the 10 years that are coming up? What do you look forward to that you would like to have happen that maybe hasn't happened yet?
Well, I still look forward to the telephone ringing because you never know who's on the other end of it.
Traveling?
No. Dick and I really feel like we've done enough traveling. There's some places. We are going to Alaska, which we haven't seen yet. And I would like to go to Bali eventually, which I haven't seen. My life is so perfect that I can only wish, here I go again, I can only wish the next 10 years are as wonderful as the last 14.
I can't think of anything better than that.
I can't either.
So if I ask you if you're happy, the answer is?
This is the best life I've ever had in my life. And I wouldn't change it for the world. There I go again. I cry at happiness and I cry at sadness and anything in between.
I can't think of anything better to finish a conversation with than being in that state of mind that you're in right now, or having that kind of a life, and I think you deserve it.
Thank you for having me.
We have so much to talk about. Will you come back and talk with us some more?
What do you think? I have anything else to say?
Oh, absolutely.
I think you've asked me everything possible.
I promise to not make you cry next
time. I would
love
to come back again.
Thank you.
Yes.